Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is my show. I have to start this episode with an erratum. The date of the Orphan Black season finale, which I mentioned in Tuesday's Ari Millen episode, is Saturday, June 20th. I got it wrong because I am dumb, but if you're listening to this on the day it drops, you can still set things right. Saturday, June 20th, 9 p.m. on Space and BBC America. Go Team Donnie and Helena. Anyway, my guest on this second episode of the week is Sarah Goodman, whose new movie Porch Stories opens at the TIFF Bell Lightbox on Friday, June 19th. See, I double-checked that. It's a lovely little picture about a few people working out some stuff on a side street in Toronto, and it features fine performances from Laura Barrett and Jose Miguel Contreras. You should check it out. Sarah's pick was Kelly Reichardt's Meek's Cutoff, a 2010 feature in which the director of Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy puts her own spin on the Western genre. Set in 1845 on the Oregon Trail, it's one of the most patient survival dramas you'll ever see, and being a Kelly Reichardt film, it's also bristling with subtext and allegorical interpretation. Michelle Williams, Will Patton, Zoe Kazan, Paul Dano, Shirley Henderson, and Neil Huff are pioneers making their way west. Bruce Greenwood is Meek, the blustering trail guide who may or may not have already gotten them lost by the time the movie begins. Reichardt isolates her characters with one another and watches as they try to work through their problems. It's really no different from her approach in Wendy and Lucy, and no less effective. It's not a Western, it's not a trail picture. It's a film where people are trying very, very hard not to acknowledge that something really terrible is lurking just beyond their field of vision. And believe it or not, that's a positive. This is someone else's movie.
Well, I go to movies often with my dad. Ever since I was a teenager, we've gone to see films together at the Cinematheque. And then when the Lightbox opened, obviously that was just like, oh, amazing. And so my dad's a real film buff. And so, yeah, he invited me to go see Meek's Cutoff. Or maybe I knew about it too. That could have been it. I could have been in the Lightbox for some other reason and I saw the poster and I had heard of Kelly Reichardt, right? So, yeah. And it's a Western. And it's by a woman filmmaker, and it's got Michelle Williams. So, of course, yeah, I wanted to see it.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I saw it at, I think I saw it on the first day of TIFF, maybe, the press screening that day. So it would have been like 11 o'clock in the morning. Mm. No one knew what to do with it. I mean, I loved it. But, right. And I'm a huge fan of her work. She's just such a unique, precise storyteller that even in something as amorphous as Night Moves or as kind of broad as Old Joy, where, you know, you really only have three characters, but the conversation spans a universe the way Before Sunrise does. She always gives you such a clear point of view and so much information about people, motivation, characters. They're real. They're always real people. She can create a society in 1845 and make them feel, well, I mean, in addition to the, I'm garbling this completely, but she loads her films with so much subtext and meaning and resonance that, yeah. I just fall into her world right away. Plus, I think I'd seen, you know, 35 movies already that year for TIFF and in the last 3 weeks, and this was just the sort of quiet space that it gives you is just right. Amazing. It enveloped me. I felt like I was being hypnotized, this whole long story of people in the middle of nowhere,
right,
going nowhere.
Yeah.
And it was like a safe space, yeah, to sort of figure out what's going on and, you know, sit there and go, oh, so is that an Iraq allegory? Is that what's going on?
Right.
Here?
And right.
Then, yeah. It wasn't until months later that I got to actually talk to her about it and ask those questions. But I love that she makes movies with the canvas that broad.
Right.
In such a small, like, they feel so physically small.
Yeah.
But so much is going on.
Well, yeah, that's like a big part of what I think, yeah, the mastery of the film is, and what, you know, I've striven to do, like in my previous films and my documentaries, is where you have like a microcosm, but then there's like this bigger social issue. Mm-hmm. But just watching Meek's Cutoff, I just felt like, wow, she's really achieved that, you know, in so many different ways. Yeah. What I've striven to do, you know, in my films is to, like, have a very personal story that people relate to on a really, like, a visceral level, but that there's, like, a deeper social issue. And that's not so much the case in Porch Stories, but in my documentaries. And then to see someone who's really kind of nailed that so well, for me, it felt like, you know, it's kind of like coming home where you're like, yeah, this is,
yeah.
You know, there's that kind of happiness you get when you see a movie that you just love so much, right?
Yeah.
And
it's synchronicity, right? Like, the movie gets you as much as you get it.
Exactly. And I guess that's the truth, that, like, everyone who goes to see a movie has a different feeling, has a different relationship to it. People experience films differently. And so, but when it's you, you feel like, oh my God, she just got me,
yeah.
You know, and it does, it feels like a real connection. And I think, you know, when you were talking about how you really believe you're in 1845, I think, you know, obviously it's everything that made that the case, but the script, there's just way that the dialogue is so spare, but so much of the dialogue gives you clues, like really roots you in the world, because they're talking, the things they're concerned about are all really practical,
mm-hmm.
and all really of that moment, like that we would never be concerned about now, right?
Yeah, and even who speaks to whom and when.
Yeah.
The gender relationships are very sharply defined,
yeah.
in that the women are constantly deferring to their husbands, even when they probably shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And it isn't until, I think, it's at least an hour before Michelle Williams even confronts, I can't remember the character's name, but she even confronts Meek.
Right.
Directly. It's all, you know, gee, husband, maybe we should be doing something else. And that, and that's also an instantly relatable thing to me as a person.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. I've been in situations where I kind of thought I should have said something sooner.
Yeah.
And nothing, you know, nothing as drastic as being lost in the Badlands forever, but even just a car trip, it's the classic joke about a man refusing to ask for directions and the woman kind of knowing that he should. It actually, she's found a way to make that joke feel historically relevant. Like, this is where the stereotype comes from.
Well, exactly. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Is you see that, you know, the kind of norms that we still live in today with gender, you kind of see it playing out there in a really stark way, where it was, like, very defined, rigidly, that, like, men made the decisions and women were dependent. And maybe it's not so rigid now, but those kind of, I mean, we're still socialized that way, that, you know, men sort of have the answers. And it's so interesting to see in the film where, like, clearly the men don't have the answers, and the one that they hired to be their leader is a really bad leader.
Yeah.
That kind of dilemma that Michelle Williams' character has of, like, I know this is not going well, I'm not in charge, what can I do, is something like I relate to as a woman, like just feeling like I've been in situations not as dire as that, where it's like you feel like what's happening doesn't make sense, but you don't necessarily feel empowered to take charge.
Yeah.
And then I think it is a feminist film because she does take charge, you know, and like when she like points the gun at Meeks, she confronts him in a way no one else has. And that for me was like an empowering moment. And I put myself in that moment. I was like, shit, would I have done that?
Yeah.
Would I have picked up the rifle, you know? And that's what it came down to, right? So I just think that the way she looks at gender, and then the way she looks at race, and the way she looks at like American imperialism, all within this very tight story, it makes it's a parable, right?
Yeah, it is. And it's a parable that I found, you mentioned the authenticity, the feeling of 1845. The details in it are incredible. And Reichardt had told me when we finally spoke, she put the actors through like pioneer boot camp. She basically, they had set up an airplane hangar and filled it with period appropriate material, like bone knitting needles and yarn that would have been wound exactly on as it would have been 150, 160 years earlier with like ancient equipment, sheared in the right way. They backfilled everything. They made sure everything was appropriate. Bonnets and the stitching, the embroidery, everything is as it would have had to be.
Right.
And the actors were allowed to walk from one end to the other and pick whatever they thought their characters would have. And that's all they had.
Yeah.
And then as a result, Michelle Williams ended up knitting scarves for everybody because she had nothing else to do. Like, Zoe Kazan taught her to knit.
Oh, cool.
On the shoot because there was nothing else to do. Like, they were hours from anywhere shooting for 10 hours a day. And she said, like, in her movies, how does she put it? On my movies, I never need the actors to pretend to be cold or hot. They're really, that's whatever's going on.
Right.
Night moves, people get rained on all the time, and they're just miserable working in a farm. Here, it's people on the prairie and the Badlands just with nothing, going slowly crazy. And all they have are old books. And you feel that by the time we join them, they're already sick of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like what you're saying, how the actors just have to experience it. I mean, that's how you experience it as the viewer, you know? When you're sitting there, like the first shot where they're crossing the river, of course, like when I watched it again, I realized how significant the river was because of the water, you know? But even the first time, you were like, it's a long shot, and they're just, it's kind of repetitive, but you're really engrossed because it's difficult, you know, like they're bringing all their possessions over this river and they're carrying it above their heads and they could slip and, you know, the cattle are walking through the water, like up really high. And, it just, there's a sense of precariousness and like high stakes just from that physical act that they have to do. And then so you're engrossed in it, you're experiencing it, and it's a different kind of film in that way. And then when they're, you know, cold and they're, well, mainly they're just thirsty, you just feel that. And so that's why the film has so much tension, even if not much is happening, because every moment that they're not getting to drink, you're like really, you know, the stakes are kind of getting higher. So it makes sense to me that the actors actually would have also been tired and thirsty, because it just seemed really dry there. And that's kind of like their biggest nemesis in a way. Like, even though they have this guy, Meeks, who is leading them astray, perhaps on purpose, perhaps not, you know, like the real nemesis in a way is just nature, right? Or will they make it?
Yeah, well, I think, like, for me, the villain in the movie is incompetence.
Right.
If you don't know what you're doing, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And that's the question that both we and they, the settlers, are wrestling with throughout, is that is Meek getting us there? Like, do we keep trusting him?
Yeah.
So we've already started to sour on the guy, and he's clearly not very good at his job. But does he know the way? Like, it just keeps coming back to that, which is why the Iraq thing makes so much sense to me in the moment. It's like, well, you're following Yahoo on on a quest to get somewhere where he's pretty sure he knows everything that's going to happen. And he says he has a plan, and how far in are we already? And how, like, we've clearly, is this the point of no return? No. Is this the point? Like, they've passed it. They don't even know that they've passed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're watching people, like, it's a process film about people who aren't getting anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's just excruciating by maybe 20 minutes in to realize that this is the movie. Like, it's not,
right.
You know, the ending of the film isn't the ending of the story.
Yeah.
And that's a very conscious choice.
Yeah.
But once you start to figure out what the shape of the film is, then that plays on you as a viewer even more than it plays on the characters. You're really in the same state of mind.
Yeah, I really, when you were talking, it made me think that the film is, it's really a critique also of followers, right?
Yeah.
It's critique, and similarly how Americans followed Bush into, you know, Iraq and, you know, voted him in, or, well, that's, you know, questionable whether they actually voted him
in.
Well,
the second time.
But, but the thing is, and for me, it was looking at that and also kind of like masculinity, the sort of the social dynamic that's going on amongst the men in the film, where they're following this man that they don't believe in. But so it's kind of emasculating, I guess. And they're not able to kind of take a stand. It's Michelle Williams' character who actually takes a stand. Like, she's not expected to. And so she's actually outside of that expectation. She takes the stand. But it's really about, like, being a follower and not actually being able to be competent, like, to take on something that doesn't make sense. So I think that's a big part of the critique, is that, like, we live, well, in Canada, there's many things as well that don't make sense that our leaders are doing.
Sure.
And we complain about it, but are we actually going to do something effective, right? And I feel like the, to change it. And I think the film is really kind of about that, and about how the guys, the men, are all kind of floundering around and feeling a lot of pressure to do the right thing, but not really, like, knowing what to do. And then they're saddled by all their prejudices and their fears, which, of course, Meeks plays on, right?
Sure, yeah.
And I guess that's part of the parable with Iraq and with, you know, the kind of fear-mongering that's gone on in the United States, you know, with Muslims, and then with used to be communists and Russians, right? But, you know, in the film, it's about this native guy, right? And he's just, Meeks is drumming up all this kind of you know, fear-laden language about how he's going to kill them all and everything.
Yeah, it's remarkably precise, considering. And again, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to read that allegorically or if it's simply that, oh yeah, they do this shit all the time. This is what a guy will do to keep his position when he feels threatened. And and Greenwood is so good at that, too. He's so... I got to talk to him about it separately.
Oh, cool.
I think we were supposed to be talking about Star Trek. And I was like, no, first we're going to talk about Meeks Cutoff.
Awesome.
He's great. And he has this kind of... He radiates confidence in person because he's an actor and he kind of has to, or else, no one will hire him. And he plays a lot of authoritarian characters. And he said that, like you get old enough and you play cops and you go from, what did he say? You go from cops to senators and you just end up getting more responsibility. He's played the president a couple of times.
That's awesome.
And with Meek, it's just like, well, okay, what if he just doesn't have the ability to project confidence?
Yeah.
Like, what if he is capable, but just look scared all the time because you're in a hostile place and he's frightened of everything.
Mm.
And it's a really interesting idea that he might be... I don't believe it. I think that's just what he came up with as an actor. I think this guy's completely incompetent.
Yeah.
But his take, I think, is, if I'm distilling it properly, is that he will get them there eventually.
Right.
He just can't tell them. He can't articulate it in a way that anyone believes.
It's interesting.
Because he falls back on bluster.
Right. And maybe also that's the character's mindset and how he had to approach it as an actor, right? To sort of... able to, I guess, connect to the character, But, I felt like that performance is really terrific. It's also, to me, the direction of him and the writing. But to conceive of a character who is, in a sense, kind of tyrannical, but it's all buffeted by his... kind of jokey nature, and it's so grating, like right from the first second you see him, and it's his physicality. So that's the actor and the director, and you don't know when one starts and the other begins, but like the whole physicality that he had, where you see the first time you meet him, you've already seen like the other characters up, like the women getting breakfast ready, and clearly this guy gets up later and he kind of gets out of the tent and stretches, and he just doesn't seem to be like, he's not like
he's not
got his stuff together. I was trying to think of the army phrase for it from my time making my first film. Was it buttoned up or whatever? I can't remember the phrase, but like he's not got his shit together, right? But the physicality of how he sort of luxuriously stretches and then he kind of saunters around, you just don't trust him right away.
Yeah.
And then the kind of stories he tells, to me, it makes you really annoyed. It's just that guy who won't stop talking and thinks everyone wants to hear his stories, but it was, I just think it was an ingenious character to come up with. All of them are great characters, but his, the way that it's played out in this kind of jokey guy, but there's like this, it makes it all like, you don't know how much malevolence there is there, but there's quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get the sense that a lot of the stories he tells, they're either calculated to make himself sound like the smartest person in the room, or he's just killed everyone else who could counteract him. Like, every other person who might contradict that story has somehow fallen off a cliff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's constantly... It's like the whole... Everything he says basically boils down to don't change horses in midstream, which was the 2004 Bush campaign, basically. Really? John Kerry? That guy? He's been to war. You don't want him.
Mm.
And the more interesting... Or rather, the more he talks, the more interesting his stories become, not for what they're saying, but for the framing device that he's employing. Like, he's remarkable. It's a great performance, but yeah, it's a remarkable character. And then in contrast to every other person who, like, people don't really speak to him. They treat him as a remote figure. Occasionally they'll come up for an audience, but they don't interact with him the same way. And he makes a point of setting himself apart, but they're also kind of scared to poke him. And so that's where, I come away with just this immense appreciation for Will Patton as an actor who's used so beautifully in that. And also in Wendy and Lucy, where he plays a very compassionate character who's ultimately not so much impotent as genuinely powerless to change events. And here he's playing a variation on that, where it's somebody who, like, you get the sense he could get his anger up if he really believed in it, but he's still deferring. He'd rather not have that fight. So let's go on another day. And the days have turned into months, and here we are. That's exactly the Canadian attitude, right? I mean, we had Rob Ford as mayor for 4 straight years, and the only time he wasn't mayor was when he was in rehab, probably. but we couldn't force him out. Like, there was nothing we could do. as a city, as a municipal government, there were no recourses because we just assume as Canadians, you know, it's never going to get that bad. We don't need a device to remove someone from office. They'll probably never happen.
Yeah.
And here you start out on this journey and everybody else is making a trip and they're all coming, like you're getting letters, everything's fine. And you pick wrong, but well, maybe we didn't pick wrong. Maybe it's our fault. Like it's a very Canadian situation.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I felt that while I was watching it too, that it's this, it does feel almost like it was made by a Canadian, right? Because it's emblematic, I think, of a struggle we have, which is to stand up and contradict or make a fuss, you know? It's better to, you know, follow along and don't make a, you know, don't make a scene, right? Yeah. And I'm Canadian and American.
Me too.
Oh, that's funny.
Were you raised primarily, because I was born and raised here, but
yeah, me too.
My mother's American, so
oh yeah,
I have the dual citizenship thing going.
Oh yeah, so do I.
Okay.
So that's funny. But yeah, my mom's from New York and my dad's from Arizona. Oh. So this landscape is like not so different from like what he grew up in, but I mean the landscape in the film,
right.
Not the landscape here in Toronto, but yeah, so I don't know, maybe that gives us a little bit more distance from it, but I still feel, yeah, very much so that dilemma that the characters are going through is one that I go through in the need to like actually stand up and do something about things that don't make sense or leaders who are not being effective or who are prejudiced. And like you said, it's sort of like, you know, you do feel like he's a strong person and yet he's deferring, but he's very conflicted about deferring, right? But that sort of politeness, yeah, that did strike me as like a very contemporary Canadian issue. You know, why are these rough pioneers being so polite? Like all the men seemed really passive aggressive in their... feelings towards and the way they demonstrated them towards Meeks, right? It was actually Michelle Williams' character who's more straightforward.
Oh yeah,
certainly when she picks up the rifle.
But, yeah, but like, it takes her forever to get there with anyone other than her husband. Like she takes even with the women, she's sort of deferential at first. But yeah, we're seeing that sliver of time where it all finally boils over. But yeah, they've put up with a great deal by the time we even meet them.
I was struck that like right away, like at the beginning of the film, she asks the husband, what did they talk about, right? And he said they were talking about hanging Meeks.
Yeah.
But the fact that like they seem to actually have a pretty decent relationship where he treated her somewhat, like not as an equal, but he would share with her the content of those decision-making meetings, right? And like he seemed to listen to her to some degree. You know, clearly he felt very bad that he was not doing better by her, but it seemed like they had, that they had something that was not equal, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and it's an interesting relationship as well because Patton has at least 20 years on Williams. There's definitely a backstory to that that we don't see.
Yeah.
Which I think is wonderful because that's something that Reichardt has clearly thought of in the casting, and I'm sure like the actors have their story.
Right.
But it never comes up. We never really get into any of the backstories of the characters, of the couples that we see. You know, Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan are an actual couple in the film, and they're playing a couple, but he was a last-minute replacement. The original actor couldn't get his visa cleared, so they basically roped in Dano.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who was completely unprepared for it, which was this is also a great story.
So they're a couple in real life?
Yeah, yeah. They've been together for, I guess it would be at least 6 or 7 years now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they were very couple-y, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. They're really convincing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're these nice kids from Brooklyn playing this 1845 pioneer couple, and I think they're supposed to have spent roughly the same amount. They basically just templated their own relationship over it, as far as I could tell.
Interesting.
He's very solicitous of her, and she's very caring for him. I've interviewed them together in the past.
Oh, okay.
They're adorable.
Right.
But here, they're adorable in hell.
Yeah.
And it's making the relationship stronger, which is kind of great, because I think that is a coincidence of their casting, because Dano really wasn't expecting to do boot camp or doing any of that. Like he came in with a few weeks to spare, as I understand
it. Oh wow!
And nails it.
Yeah, like absolutely.
There's also something about him that just looks better in period. I don't totally understand it, but he's really convincing in those little vests. Like
yeah, he was very, and like the fact that he's quite young, right? Mm. Like he's much younger than the other men.
Yeah,
you know, and yet he's being treated as a full kind of member of the...
Yeah, he's got voting rights. He's an equal. Yeah,
yeah. And so that was quite interesting. And it made you also think that at that time period, like, you became an adult much earlier. Like, you had to assume a lot of responsibility. But they're also kind of more emotional than the rest. And, like...
Well, he wears his fear a lot more.
Yeah, and so obviously. Is she, right? And, like, she... So they kind of, like, are more exuberant in that way. You know, so you can see how it's almost a bit more contemporary.
Yeah. And it gives you the, again, you get the sort of contrasts in the, amidst the couples. You have the older, more seasoned pair, and then you have the kids who are just terrified all the time, like all the time.
Yeah. And he's very impressionable, right? Because he's the one that's most influenced by Meeks and Meeks' bravado and his stories of like the treachery of, you know, these native folks and what they're going to do. And he's really impressionable to that. So you can see how he's flip-flopping.
Like,
he's about to vote yes, you know.
Yeah, in the allegory version, I see him as the South.
Yeah.
He's just never actually experienced terrorism or terror, but, well, it could happen tomorrow. We got to be careful. Mm-hmm. That constant sense of escalation as a possibility.
Even what I like is that there's still kind of gray zones with the characters, that even though the Michelle Williams character is kind of like... The strongest and in a sense does the best by the native guy who's supposed to be Coyote, I think. Mm. And but even her, she's totally prejudiced, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, realistic of how someone like that would have been, right?
She
says that stuff about how, you know, like, you have no idea what we have. We have these cities, like, because she's, like, sewing up his moccasin, right? But she's just like, this technology is nothing compared to what we have. And I just think that way of showing that, kind of like the gray zones there, that it's not like she actually thought of the indigenous guy as, like, her equal at all, even though she was kind of at least treating him somewhat as a human being, right?
Well, that's it. She can see him as a person, but not... Or she can see him as a human, but not necessarily as a person.
Yeah.
That's a really... Oh, it's a really precise thing a lot of period movies forget. Eastwood got it right. David Peoples got it right in Unforgiven, which is they're not evolved yet. Like, these people haven't come through the next 150 years with us. Like, we're still a little bit further ahead, or at least we know how to sound like we are. And they don't have that. They don't pretend to be more civil or more social if they don't like you, or if they are thinking of you as a thing, they wouldn't bother to hide it because prejudice is acceptable.
Right.
At the time. And it's okay to treat someone as that thing instead of a person. You know, like, this is still, you know, black people are still 3/5 of a white man. It's like, that's their reality. They're living in that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the movie is steeped in that sort of prejudice, but it only comes up when it's necessary. It's accepted. Like, they're constantly convinced that the evil Indians are going to descend on them and murder them, even when no one's speaking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely just there, and
it's the empty space. It's the way the frame works.
Yeah, and they're it's true that it's very frank. Like, they're when they capture the guy and they bring him to the camp, the native guy. It's they stare at him like he's an animal, right? And there's nothing today. People who felt like doing that would try and do it like with an averted gaze.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just, like you said, it was just like an accepted thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that shows sort of how we've changed, but also how we haven't changed, you know, because...
Yeah. The impulse is still there among a lot of people.
Yeah, because it's about the other, right? To fear this other that we don't know, but like... And we don't really know about this character, right? Because they can't communicate. And we don't really know if he's bringing them to water. And we see him almost kind of smile when the wagon smashes. So, you know, he does seem to be taking pleasure out of their misfortune. But, like, why wouldn't he? He's been, like, captured by them, right? So we, you know, that's another part of the mystery and part of the gray zones. We don't actually know that he's any... like what he's up to and what he's thinking.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, he might be the Obama figure. Like, he's an exotic foreign person who might be just like them, which ultimately was what Obama turned out to be. You know, like, Patton Oswalt had this amazing thing about how his 2002 self would never believe that a black man named Barack Hussein Obama would be able to be president after 9/11. But look, we're not that bad. Like, the future still has hope. Or you're right. He it's left open enough that he might simply be operating against them.
Right.
Not even, or just nothing. Like, he might simply be waiting for his first chance to walk away and leave them there. And the movie is really quite lovely in the way that it absolutely refuses to tell you.
Yeah.
Because that's just not what it's interested in. And it's this film of remarkable contradictions, because it's, on some levels, it's deeply cynical. On others, it felt to me to be really optimistic. I want to believe they're going to get out of there eventually, mm-hmm. but it's just going to be worse.
Yeah.
You could also take it the reading that, you know, like the standard reading of any film with an ambiguous ending, oh, they're already dead and it's purgatory, which wasn't true of Lost, isn't true of this. Or, you know, and it's just all of these contradictions happening at once. It's a present day meditation on a pre-Civil War mentality, and it's like, it's a Western, but it's not a Western. It's a gorgeous widescreen canvas that's being shot in Academy ratio, which
right.
freaked us all out
yeah.
at the beginning, because it's a playful decision that isn't being made in a playful movie. Like, it's a really weird, she just said she wanted to make it feel antiquated.
Right.
But, you know, your first thought is that the projector's broken, that there's something wrong.
Right.
So what was, yeah, you saw it with your dad. How did people respond to it?
I can't quite remember, to be honest, because mm-hmm. I saw it, like, whatever, 5 years ago, and yeah. I've rewatched it since then. But I mean, my dad and I loved it. I think it's probably a film, I think it was probably a pretty muted sort of sense in the room, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely in terms of the frame, I kind of felt like she didn't want to do that widescreen thing, which is so beautiful. Like, she, even though she has these wide landscapes, she kind of wanted to chop it mm-hmm. in a way so you don't get to see it all, because you're more confronted then with the situation, and you're more trapped. That's sort of the feeling I had watching it. It seemed to make sense that it would have been framed that way.
Yeah. And it's another contradiction. You know, it's an open-air movie. They've got nothing around them, but it's still incredibly claustrophobic.
Yeah.
To watch those heads in that space just boxed in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't really remember the reactions of people there, but I could see how it's not for everybody, you know? I just really, the slowness of the film, I really like experiencing, because everything is so life and death. And so it's not like you're interpreting anything. You're actually just kind of in it,
mm-hmm.
you know, with them. And I think, you're placing yourself, like, how would I react in this kind of situation?
Yeah.
I think something also really remarkable for me about the film is the editing of it, because it's very impressionistic. Their journey, their wandering is, like, told in these little snippets, right? It's not necessarily one right after another. And I think it's obvious that the shooting is really beautiful and, you know, but when you actually look at also the construction of it, it was so well done. And it's partly what makes you feel kind of in that purgatory or trapped, because you're just going from this kind of dreamlike, almost like hallucinogenic moment to moment. But it's very lean. And that's what another thing I really like about the film, like that there's nothing extra, and like it seems to cut at exactly like the right moment.
Yeah,
you know?
For a film that doesn't really have a lot of forward motion, it's got a great deal of urgency. And I think that's because it establishes, it's a crisis situation by the time we meet them.
Yeah.
And, you could have the prey, like, I was trying to think about how this would have worked had it been made in the 30s or 40s, and wouldn't have had any of the subtext, I suspect. It would have been a much straighter, it would just be the midsection of Stagecoach without the wagon chase. It would just be people riding and complaining at each other.
Mm.
But it wouldn't have any dramatic resonance. Like, this is just about the quiet moments that are either despair or panic, and everyone is trying to hide that from everyone else. So you're constantly seeing people, even just to the point of not being willing to confront Meek on his mistakes, they're hiding their real motivation, but then they're also revealing themselves on a really profound level to their partners, because this might be the last day they have together. And like,
right.
there's this impending doom. I picture the movie with clouds over everything in my mind, even though it's sunblasted and yellow, like it's a yellow film.
Right.
But I picture these dark, foreboding thunderclouds in the corners, because this is all going to end badly.
Yeah.
Unless it doesn't.
Yeah, well, you know, there's many moments where, I guess, when the Will Patton character joins Meeks off on the horses, and, like, to find the native guy, and then Michelle Williams' character is just waiting there, and she calls his name, right? And she's afraid that he's not going to come back. And And then when the other husband, you know, falls, he faints, he's clearly ill. You know that from early on when he's refusing to eat more. And it's, you have this sense that they're like, yeah, like this might be the end of my partner. And again, she lays that, sets that up just so, with just like a little scene and just a few words, you know, where she's trying to offer the man stew and he won't take it, or he won't take extra food. And you know that there's something not quite, like he's maybe a bit ill.
Yeah.
But I think I just, one thought I had too, in terms of talking about it as a Western, I think for me, I mean, certainly it's got a slower pace than a lot of Westerns, but it seems like very clearly a Western conceived of by a woman, right? Like as maybe this sort of newer wave of what Western films are like that actually show what it actually was like.
Yeah.
Because that's what this feels like. This feels like this is what it actually was like to be a pioneer, and specifically, you know, as a woman. So that to me is partly why I love the movie, because it's like a really new entry to the Western canon, I guess.
Yeah.
And when I saw Dead Man, I also felt that this is it's showing the West more like how it actually was without the romanticism. So it seems like that's, you know, I don't know if that was the first one, but that Meek's Cut Off is another film that's actually more kind of revisiting that time, but more like how it actually was.
Yeah, sort of a both demythologizing and just like a patient Western. I'm thinking of the way Steve McQueen's Patient Camera in 12 Years a Slave uses the passage of time and a lot of fixed shots, but patience is the wrong word here, I suppose, like, just they're emotional Westerns, they're observational Westerns, this is what it would feel like.
Yeah.
John McClane has a movie coming out in a couple of weeks called Slow West.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
It's really good, but it's the other side of it. It's a much more stylized and yet still kind of practical, realistic Western. It's, you know, people would shoot each other in the back a lot. That's what it boils down to. It's just there's very little honor and more about survival. But there's a lot of other stuff going on. And here, honor isn't even part of it. There's no time. Like, that's miles behind us. So yeah, this is just the reality of being out in the frontier in a hostile world.
Right.
Where it's not that you can't trust anyone, but you just don't know what to do. Like I think they've already figured out who they can trust.
Right.
But the next step is the question. And that's, yeah, they're paralyzed. They're sort of trapped on that precipice. And it gives it an emotional grounding that, yeah, Reichardt is great at. She's an incredible... Wendy and Lucy unfolds in a series of vignettes. It's Michelle Williams' character is looking for her dog. Wendy's looking for Lucy in a little place in Oregon, in a small town where no one can help her because they haven't seen her dog. And that's all it is. And she goes from person to person to person. Weirdly enough, the Dardenne kind of stole the structure for 2 days, one night.
Huh.
But it's every person she meets is a full character, even if they only spend 3 minutes on camera. She gives you this entire history of human beings every time they walk into frame. And what she does here is she gives us that in the first 2 minutes, I guess. And we see who everybody is and how they relate. And then the next 2 minutes are how they relate to each other. And then there's 100 minutes of space where we're just left with them as the pieces pop, you know, like sort of move off of each other on a board. Yeah, it's a hell of a movie.
Yeah, it just really strikes me how she's able to do that so quickly. She knows, like, the exact either dialogue or action or something about what they're wearing that then conveys so much about who they are. Like, the Zoe Kazan character who's bringing the bird. I mean, that just says everything about her, right? Like, in that first shot, she's going across the river and she's got the bird in a cage. And, like, of all the belongings that they're going to such effort to save is this thing that's like frivolous in a way, you know. But like there's so many ways that she does that's quite with like a slight gesture. And from a moment from Wendy and Lucy that I remember, a clip she's talking to an older man, and it just seems to say so much about like the state of like unemployment, or you know, not being able to make ends meet even if you have multiple jobs, like so much about sort of like the economy in the United States and what's been going on. But it's done, it's sort of like every word is needed and nothing is extra.
Yeah, nobody asks for understanding in Reichardt's movies. They just sort of exist already. They're there to be understood by us.
Right.
She's not big on monologues, although there sort of is one. in Night Moves, but it's irrelevant in a weird way. Like,
right.
She's really good at that, at letting us know how the film feels about the things that it's showing you.
Right.
And, Meeks, I don't know if Meeks is her best film or if Wendy and Lucy is, but they're... Because Wendy and Lucy, I was saying, destroyed me. I saw it at Cannes by myself, and it was like a year and a half after I'd lost my dog, and I just had to go off and be alone for a good half hour before I could even go start to write about it. It just pulverized me.
Yeah.
And that doesn't actually, that sounds like I'm spoiling Wendy and Lucy. That's not what it's about, but it's about the potential.
Right.
It's about a person separated from their dog, and it just crushed me.
Yeah.
And and Meeks Cutoff has a very different tone. It still trades in ambiguity for the entire running time. It's like a Schrodinger's box where they're either going to get out or they're not, and we won't know until the movie's over, and even then it's still kind of up to us. Wendy and Lucy has a much more clear ending, but it's equally punishing as an experience, as an emotional investment, because, you know, this could all end very, very badly at any given minute, and you're just trapped in the space with them watching it, waiting for it to go wrong.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing Wendy and Lucy.
Yeah.
But I love the ending of Meeks Cutoff because, you know, you're talking about who's in charge. And it's at that moment that Meeks relinquishes being in charge, but in such a passive-aggressive way,
yeah.
Right? Because they are taking a vote of what they should do. And then Meeks is like, well, you know, you guys are in charge now. But he specifically says, you know... Michelle Williams' character and her husband, you two are in charge, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the burden is on them now. And so I don't know, but you don't get really any satisfaction from that. You know, it's not like you get a sense of satisfaction from, like, now the people who should be in charge are in charge. Because I guess they don't really have any information either.
Yeah.
And you wonder how come they just didn't have more... knowledge of what they were doing before they set forth on this, right?
Yeah.
And it's
but it also gives him the out, right? Like, he's no, if he
of course
disavows responsibility, and it's like that really weird alpha male thing of putting it, well, his wife made him, like, by implicating both of them.
Yeah.
It also potentially absolves Patton and puts it all on the woman.
Yeah. But that. He's shaming him, like, as if,
yeah,
he's
exactly.
been whipped by his wife, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly, like, in the last shot, or the second to last shot, when she's, like, looking through that gnarled tree, there's, like, a space in the tree, and she's looking through it
mm-hmm.
at the native guy who's walking off, you know. What is she thinking? What is that about, you know? She's looking through a porthole, it seems,
yeah.
you know? And
or that's all her vision is left, like, it's narrowed to that point, where
right.
she can only see that one thing. Again, totally ambiguous. It could go either way, I think.
I agree. I mean, I tend to be an optimistic person. So when I see that tree, I'm like, okay, maybe they're going to make it. And I tend to like open endings too.
Yeah.
So I like to think that they're going to make it. But I think it's really more about her genesis, like her, the way that she grows. And I'm, you know, how does she change? She kind of takes charge to some degree, you know. But I'm not sure what that last shot means, like, in terms of she's looking off through that porthole, at her future. And, I don't really know. Is she, you know, she's pondering the mystery of the guy who's now really got the most power,
mm-hmm.
right? Who's leading them on. But I don't really know what she's thinking.
Yeah. And that's sort of wonderful, you know, to be left with that, to be left in that space. And the and that brings me to the stock question that I ask of people on
sure.
the show, which is, like, was there, or what element of it has influenced you? Is there, can you cite anything in the film that feels like your work might have been nudged in a certain direction or influenced by it?
Well, I think in the sense that, you know, that her stories are, it feels like a miniature, and that I could see that Porch Stories is also kind of like this microcosm, and where you're sort of looking at a smaller world, but there's a bigger world. I'd say that, like, her preciseness with her dialogue is something I really strive to, or just her preciseness with the whole way that she's conceived of the story. You know, in my next film, which is called Lake 239, and it's an environmental thriller, there's a way where, yeah, I'm very much influenced by what she's done here and how she's put a personal story the forefront, but then there's this, like, social issue, which is really, well, there's many social issues at play. So, and then also the fact that she has this female character who goes through this kind of journey to being, to having more power, though it's not perfect at all, and it's very fraught, right? And it's not, you also see how, like, sexism has affected that character. So I think all those things are influences for me. But the, yeah, I guess in sort of the films that I hope to make in the future, a lot is the case. Yeah, her kind of preciseness and the way that it's so observational. And partially maybe it's my documentary background, but that's always been so crucial to me, is to observe, to let the audience make up their own mind, to let the audience go on a journey. And I think, like, in Meek's Cut Off, the audience is experiencing that journey. You know, I just don't like hitting people over the head with anything. And so I think that her films are really understated, and it kind of creeps up on you, and the implications creep up on you. So, yeah, I guess there's, like, many, many ways that she's an influence, and also, like, of what I haven't made, but, like, my next film.
I'm really curious. You said you hadn't seen Night Moves. You won't allow yourself to see it until you're finished prepping or even making like 239.
I think once I've nailed the script, I would watch it. For me, you know, I'm writing this thriller. It's very different than anything I've written. And Porch Stories is, you know, it's got these intertwining stories. It's kind of, you know, this little charming sort of look at a fabric of a neighborhood, right? But when you're doing a thriller where there's suspense and there's, like, higher stakes, there's life and death, and there's also the characters are battling with the environment, or, like, with the landscape, similarly as in Meek's Cut Off. And you want to, there's also kind of an element of a spy in their midst, and just being able to craft it so the suspense pays off, so that you don't know from 100 miles off, like, who the spy is. Sure. All those kind of things are just part of, like, writer's craft that I'm still learning. And I kind of feel like I need to go on that journey first with other, like, with a story editor's help before I watch Night Moves, because I guess I'm concerned of watching something that might be quite similar to my film before I've nailed it.
Sure.
I like to watch things that are actually similar in some ways but different in other ways. Like, when I was making Army of One, my, like, first documentary about young people in the army, I watched a lot of, like, war movies, but not documentaries. I watched dramas.
Okay.
You know, like Full Metal Jacket, because that to me, because my film in many ways is kind of constructed like a drama, but it is a documentary, so there was, like, a divide, enough of a difference so that I could sort of be inspired by it or learn from it, but it's not too similar.
Right.
So I'm just I'm dying to see Night Moves, but yeah, I think I'm going to wait until I just have the script in a better place. And it may end up that actually my film is quite different in a lot of ways. But yeah,
I'm very curious to see it.
Well, yeah, we just have to get it made.
My thanks to Sarah Goodman, whose movie Porch Stories opens tomorrow, Friday, June 19th, at the TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto. I'll be doing a Q&A with Sarah after the 6:45 show on Sunday, June 21st, so come see us and say hi. Meek's Cut Off is available in North America in a very fine DVD and Blu-ray edition produced by Oscilloscope Entertainment. You can also find it for rent or sale on iTunes. And you can find Sarah on Twitter at Goody. That's good with 6 E's after it. Just start typing, it'll come up. You can find me online at Norm Wilner on Twitter and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, on Twitter or on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, who am I to stop you? Thanks for listening.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.